And my mission, which is to get you to the hospitality suite without delay. So let's cut to the chase. Thank you for the introduction. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to the members of this society. I have to tell you, I feel like a B-teamer who's been invited to make a brief appearance with the varsity. I mean, this is a tremendous organization with a rich history, and I'm not exactly sure why I get to make this brief appearance on the field, but I don't expect to be here again, but it's really a gratifying experience for me. My topic, I think, is to provide at least one person's answer to the question, can there be a conservative foreign policy? Or to broaden the question just slightly, is it possible to define a principled foreign policy to which all or most self-identified conservatives can subscribe? I gave this question deep thought for roughly 2 minutes and concluded that the answer is self-evidently no. It's no for two reasons, I think. First of all, for all of the impressive contributions of American writers and intellectuals, conservative writers and intellectuals, since World War II, the fact is that a cohesive, unified conservative movement as such has never existed in this country. At best, conservatism has existed as an uneasy and often fractious coalition kept together by a common antipathy for the left generally and for communism specifically. I don't recall where I first encountered that argument. It probably was many years ago when I first read George Nash's History of Postwar Conservatism. As many observers have noted of late, that coalition has now all but collapsed. The demise of communism weakened it, and I have to say, at least one conservative's judgment, the Iraq War destroyed it. Indeed, the notorious article that David Frum published in National Review back in 2003 seemed almost intended to make it impossible for the coalition ever to be restored. According to Frum, those members of the right who opposed the Iraq War, quote, began by hating the conservatives. They came to hate their party and this president. They have finished by hating their country. Well, hate is a strong word, and it does not seem to have been a word that was chosen in order to try to encourage some sort of dialogue. Frum concluded his article by saying that war is a great clarifier. It forces people to take sides. The paleoconservatives have chosen, and the rest of us must choose too. In a time of danger, they have turned their backs on their country, and now we turn our backs on them. As somebody who used to subscribe to National Review, the fact that this article appeared in National Review, long recognized as the flagship periodical of American conservatism, that fact seemed to endow this article with a little bit of extra authority. I used to write for National Review sometimes, occasionally in those days, and I do remember a conversation that I had. I don't know whether it was with Rich Lowry or Jade Nordlinger, but it was when the article came out, and I said, you know, it seems to me that a statement like this perhaps ought to lead to an opportunity for some sort of a symposium or discussion or willingness to entertain other points of view, and they weren't interested in that idea. It's their magazine. It's not my magazine. I didn't take any offense at that. But the fact that there was no interest in talking about this charge that was made against those who opposed the war struck me as that much more evidence that there really was an interest in dialogue. So others may disagree, but I see no way of restoring the conservative coalition. I really suspect that the Iraq War, which is going to go on for a long time, will be like the Vietnam War in this sense, that even when the Iraq War ends, in a sense it won't end. That the divisions caused by and misunderstandings caused by the Iraq War are going to continue to play themselves out for some substantial period of time, even after the shooting has stopped. And that's one reason why we're not going to see anything like a unified conservative approach to foreign policy anytime soon. The second reason we're not going to see anything resembling a conservative foreign policy has to do with the debased condition of American politics. On this point, it seems to me that the recent article by Professor George Carey, describing the American political system as it actually works today, as opposed to how we fancy it ought to work, that this article by Professor Carey has it exactly right. Writing in the fall issue of Modern Age, I saw there's still copies of that out in the vestibule, writing in the fall 2005 issue of Modern Age, Carey noted the extent to which capturing the White House has now come to be the be-all and the end-all of national politics. Both parties are fully in the thrall of the cult of the presidency. Each party exists for one purpose alone: to get their guy, or perhaps soon their gal, into the White House and then share in the boodle. As Professor Carey writes in that piece, principle is abandoned or rationalized into meaninglessness when it stands athwart the overriding interest of the political party to gain and perpetuate its control of the presidency. In this regard, the Republican Party today is devoted, for example, to the principles of limited government and fiscal responsibility, precisely to the extent to which the Democratic Party is devoted to the ideals of equality and social justice, that is to say, virtually not at all. As a branch of government charged with grave constitutional responsibilities, Congress can hardly be said to exist. Apart from the occasional contrived issue like the Dubai ports deal, its main function in all matters related to national security lies in deferring to the imperial presidency. The point is simply this: even if, despite all odds, the conservative coalition were restored, the corruption of American politics and the erosion of the separation of powers are so advanced that the chance of that coalition implementing its program is next to nil. Perhaps I ought to stop here. That is to say, my answer to the question I was asked to discuss is no. But on the assumption that what this group really wants from its keynote speaker is not simply to declare the issue moot, but to promote a conversation, let me offer one conservative's notion of what a conservative foreign policy ought to look like. And let me take as my text an extraordinary quotation from Christopher Lash that I came across the other day when paging through my brand new copy of the Encyclopedia of American Conservatism, a quite, I think, extraordinary achievement. In an essay that appeared in First Things in 1990, Christopher Lash wrote, "The central conservative insight is that human freedom is constrained by the natural conditions of human life, by the weight of history, by the fallibility of human judgment, and by the perversity of the human will. Well, it seems to me that the immense wisdom in that observation ought to have profound application in the realm of statecraft. In my personal judgment, a conservative foreign policy ought to rest on the following principles. First, a conservative foreign policy ought to respect history, which is not a triumphal march toward the sunny uplands of freedom, but a tale of tragedy, miscalculation, and overreaching. It is not given to us to know the direction or the purpose of history. It is preposterous for us to claim otherwise. Therefore, we must be modest in our aims and modest in our expectations. Second principle, given the fallen state of man and given the nature of international politics, a conservative foreign policy will recognize the impossibility of achieving anything like world peace, or the impossibility of exerting ourselves in order to bring about the universal embrace of liberal democracy. In that regard, a conservative foreign policy ought not to disdain stability. To the extent that we can create and maintain stability, we've actually achieved quite a lot. If the second principle implies that in a disordered world, we need to keep our powder dry, the third principle counsels prudence and wariness when it comes to war. Yes, emphatically, there are occasions when war is necessary. But war is a toxic drug, and it needs to be used sparingly. The more I contemplate the long record of military history, the more I am struck by how seldom the resort to arms yields decisive victory. That is to say, a victory that makes a clean sweep of the political problems that give rise to war in the first place. I am struck further by the fact that time and again, war gives rise to enormous and unexpected consequences, and war leaves nasty, loose ends. As often as it solves the problem, war leaves new ones in its wake. Again, that's not a counsel of pacifism. That's not a counsel of weakness. That's a counsel of prudence. From a conservative point of view, moreover, war's impact on the fragile domestic institutions that make liberty possible on the home front is almost always negative. Randolph Bourne was right. War is the health of the state. Alas, war is not the health of armies. Foolish wars frequently deplete armies, leaving us vulnerable when real danger appears. Fourth principle. Given the dangers of Leviathan, and given the corrupting effects of power, conservatives will always want to keep a wary eye on the politicians who claim the need for more power in order to keep us safe. Conservatives should view as anathema the doctrine that the authority of the commander-in-chief is without limit, especially when the commander-in-chief says that we are condemned to something akin to perpetual war. Fifth principle. Conservatives will always be mindful of the fact that the purpose of this union is not to save the world, but to preserve the American experiment in order liberty. Given the state of our culture, that's a tough enough job. Indulging in imperial pretensions complicates that job rather than facilitating it. Conservatives will agree with Charles Beard. This is my first inflammatory point, to say something nice about Charles Beard. Conservatives will agree with Charles Beard that we ought to tend first to cultivating our own garden, which is today badly in need of repair. In order to cultivate that garden, a conservative foreign policy will look toward reclaiming our freedom of action. In this regard, the words of Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, the senior, it seems to me, apply. Lodge wrote, "Let us make it our policy that what we shall do and when we shall do it shall be determined by us." How might these principles apply to our current situation? And here I'll wrap up in about 2 minutes. I can see you leaning in that direction. Several thoughts. One, and this is probably where I start flipping the grenades under people's pup tents, but I do it respectfully. First implication, the Bush doctrine of preventive war is the height of recklessness, and prudence requires its abrogation. Second implication, the invasion of Iraq was unnecessary and it was misguided. It is draining our resources. It is distracting our attention from far more urgent priorities. And the need to liquidate this misadventure is imperative. Third implication, transforming the broader Middle East lies beyond our ability to accomplish. The proper response to the threat posed by Islamic radicalism, and I have not an inkling of a doubt that the threat is a real one, the proper response to the threat posed by Islamic radicalism lies in devising a new strategy of containment. Won't look like the strategy of containment of the Cold War, but will have the same purpose. Combined with a ruthless international police action to dismantle and to destroy Al-Qaeda. Fourth implication. We have wildly overstated the capacity and the durability of American military power. We need to reduce the burdens on the force, and that implies reducing our profile overseas. For starters, it's time to remove U.S. forces from Europe and let the Europeans defend themselves. It's time for us to make clear our intentions to withdraw U.S. forces from Japan and from South Korea and let the Japanese and the Koreans also defend themselves. Well, hoping that these brief remarks will provide the basis for a continuing conversation over drinks, I will stop. And I will stop thanking you for the opportunity to speak to the Philadelphia Society. Thank you.